So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And today, it's going to be all about the MacBook Air, the M1 edition that was just announced a couple of weeks ago and we reviewed this week. Was it actually last week? Time just doesn't
I think it was last week.
But hey, time doesn't mean anything anymore. A week feels like a month, and a month feels like a year at this point. So we'll be diving into that and some of the latest news, including Twitter fleets and, hey, Amazon getting into pharmacy stuff. That's weird. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That one's especially important because that's just super helpful in general. And you can email us at podcast@engadget.com. We typically record live around 10 a.m. Eastern on Thursday, so you can join us at our YouTube channel for live Q&A, and maybe you can even be a part of the episode if you mention something really cool. So check that out. So let's talk about the MacBook Air M1. I don't even know what the official name of this is, because in our review I just called it the MacBook Air M1, but
yeah,
it's the M1 equipped MacBook Air that Apple just released. I loved it. It is one of the highest scores I've ever given an Apple laptop, mainly because this thing feels so freaking fast. So just for full context, go check out my review. Go check out my video produced by Brian O. That really just gets to all of it. But my main takeaways, God damn, this thing is so freaking fast. And it's so fast, it doesn't even have a fan. It is a fanless design that in our benchmarks clocked higher than Intel and AMD's chips on any Ultra Portable. And honestly, it even clocked higher than those chips on beefier gaming PCs in some respects. So I think it's incredibly impressive, and I cannot wait to see it running on the MacBook Pro and the Mac Mini and maybe, you know, other systems down the line. It's insane what Apple has managed to do here, but that's my main takeaway. This is a crazy cool computer. But Sherlyn, what are your thoughts on the Mac Mini? Are you excited by this thing?
The MacBook Air.
For MacBook Air.
I haven't touched it, I haven't used it, but I have heard a lot about it. The reviews went up on Tuesday, and Twitter was, because I'm in tech Twitter, and it was just everyone was super hype about it, which is quite impressive. Now, I trust you, Devendra, of course. So if you say it's good, I believe it's good. But when everyone in the industry agrees, I think that is kind of...
Then you're like, I don't know.
No. Then I'm like...
contrarian.
I was trying to be nice. I want to be like, if Devendra says it, I'm not sure. But if everyone in the industry says...
That's not, again, not nice, but okay. I get it.
I'm kidding.
So yeah, unanimous approval of this thing. And I think like when Apple was talking about the M1 chip and these systems, I think we were all a little...
skeptical.
Justifiably skeptical, because they were saying things like, this is the fastest core PC ever made. And I think they actually adjusted some of those stats. It is the fastest, like, low power core, so like the fastest ARM core, but not the fastest like desktop high performance core, because AMD does beat them in some respects. But for what this chip is, for something that is in a 2.8 pound laptop that is super thin, the design has not changed from the last MacBook Air we reviewed like earlier this year. So it has the same, like, it has a good keyboard, it has the, you know, revamped keyboard, not the butterfly. Great sleek design. The unibody stuff hasn't changed very much, but it's what's in it that counts. And man, this thing flies. Like, the when I pulled it out of the box and I just like opened it up a little, it was just boom, ready to go through setup. There is practically no wait for it to wake up from sleep. So that was always great. But also, it just feels fast. Like, the interface almost feels like they took what makes iOS feel so fast and brought it over to Mac. And that's essentially what it is, right? Because it is an ARM-based chip, macOS Big Sur is optimized for this new hardware. And it just feels like all of a sudden the Mac hardware and software sides are just running in concert, which to me has always been the best part of iOS. You know, I feel like I like a lot about Android phones, but the thing a lot of Android phones do is like they try to throw in special features or extra hardware or extra cameras to kind of mimic some of the like harmonious experience Apple can deliver because they're building their own hardware and software, right? Apple can take advantage of more stuff, whereas Android phones will have to, you know, put in a lot more hardware to deliver a similarly smooth experience in some respects. So they're basically recreating that on Macs, and I think that's really exciting. I'm sure Mac fans are happy about this too, because it makes Apple systems more than just PCs mm-hmm. running macOS, right? Like when Apple switched over to Intel chips in 2005, that was a monumental shift. That basically meant under the hood, everything in a Mac was pretty much the same as what was in a Windows PC. And there was like a bit less of a luster to the Mac experience. Now Apple can be like, hey, you have an ultra portable that starts at $999, is faster than pretty much most other, you know, laptops out there, any Windows PCs. Mm-hmm. That seems like a hard thing to ignore. Like anybody looking at a new computer now can be like, oh, I want the Mac hardware because it has great battery life, yeah. because it's so powerful. This thing lasted 16 and a half hours in our benchmark, and during regular usage, the battery like would barely tick down. I was able to like use it all day. Maybe by 8 p.m. it would be down to like 30%. But it's just like hardcore because this is a mobile processor. So, hey, a lot of what Apple was saying turns out is true. And it is crazy what this thing is able to do. It's very fast. It's the fastest web browser performance I've ever seen on a notebook or even a desktop, to be honest.
You're like talking Safari about Safari, though. So yeah. Quickly.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, that's the main thing, right? So there are native apps now that are built for the M1 chip. And everything else runs through Rosetta 2 emulation. But I was surprised. Even that felt good. Like I didn't notice any significant slowdown, and even though they're not fully optimized, they still felt like they were running on a fast PC. So Apple did something here that Microsoft really didn't. Could you talk to us about, you know, what Microsoft did when they tried to bring Windows to ARM?
I guess that's the thing, is my question to you, which and a question that a lot of people have too, is mm-hmm. why is the or how is the emulation better? Because Microsoft's emulation introduces some quirks, I think, to the system. I haven't done a head-to-head comparison, so I can't really tell the difference. Like when you say, you know, apps run natively on the emulator fast, I don't know. I feel like
not natively on the, but apps just run on the emulator, because there's a difference, right? The native apps and emulated apps. Yeah,
the apps that you're talking about that can't mm-hmm. run on the that run on the emulator. I want to see how that same app runs on a Windows on ARM machine, so that I of that comparison to know for myself how the emulator behaves.
Here's the main thing. Some of those apps just don't even run on the Windows on ARM machine, right? You reviewed the Surface Pro X.
Right. That's because the support isn't very clear. Now, one thing I saw actually a screenshot on Twitter is when the you go to a download page for an app installer. The pop-up actually asks if you want to download the ARM-based version or the Intel-based version, which I think is interesting.
Oh, I haven't even seen that.
I saw a screenshot. I'm not entirely 100% sure if this is happening on the M1 MacBook Air. But if that's the case, that's all I've been asking Microsoft to do. That is literally what I want out of Microsoft, because you just have to make it clear to people what apps can and can't be installed, but they haven't even done that. And that's been my biggest problem with Windows on ARM. The emulator is fine. It's workable. It certainly doesn't sound as if it's as smooth as Apple's. But app compatibility will always be an issue when you're talking about getting people to port legacy apps over to a new system.
It is. But here's the thing. Like when it comes to compatibility, there are apps like 64-bit apps in particular that literally do not run. You cannot even launch them. You can't do anything.
On Microsoft, yes.
On Windows, on ARM.
Yeah.
On Mac, what Apple has done is Rosetta 2 just handles everything just fine. Yeah. 32-bit apps, 64-bit apps. It is seamless to me as a user, which I think is the main thing here. Like if I downloaded an app from the Mac store, it doesn't tell you upfront if it's Mac or Intel, but it'll give you the best available app. If you do a, you know, command I for get info, you can see on the binary if it's a native app or an Intel app. But to a normal user, it actually doesn't matter because everything still runs great. So,
and that's important.
I think that's important. That's the main thing. Maybe Mac users aren't as used to just going around the web and downloading random installers, which you can still do. And I did that for a bunch of things.
Right.
It was fine. Whereas Windows users, they're more used to going to download.com or finding an EXE or something. And it is a difference too. Like the Windows Store, I think, does a better job of telling you which apps actually run on Windows on ARM hardware. But even then, there's not much there. So,
right. The thing is, technically, yeah. we were talking about this in a previous episode, which is all the stuff from the Windows Store should run on Windows on ARM. It will.
Yes.
But because, like you said, there's just a dearth of apps. There's not that many apps on the Windows Store. And so it's like Windows users, it feels a little shortchanged here.
Yeah, like I would never recommend anybody buy the Surface Pro X. Like, as cool as that hardware looks, as sleek as it looks, it is the most modern Surface laptop or Surface tablet we've ever seen. But why would you buy a $1,000 computer that can't run more like a lot of Windows apps? Like, you just cannot work on it the way you would a normal Windows PC. Anybody can go buy this MacBook Air or any M1 computer and just start working. And I think that's the main thing, right? Your workflow doesn't have to change. I didn't have to do anything different because I was using this computer. I was being more aware because I knew what I was testing here. But if I was just a consumer who bought this thing, I'd be like, wow, Apple's laptops are just much better than everybody else's. And that's all that really matters, you know?
It's to me, I just there are still some head-to-head comparisons I want to make. Like,
sure.
You say it wakes up instantly. I want to see how that compares, because Instant Wake is also a feature of Snapdragon PCs. And battery life would be good to just kind of compare head-to-head too. But again, those are, we're going down to the nitty-gritty, I feel like. I think if you look at how overwhelming the positive response has been across the industries, it's clear that Apple has done a really great job. And surprisingly so. I think a lot of us were very skeptical to start with.
Hey, I mean, and you brought up Snapdragon PCs. Hey. We've seen a lot of companies try to bring ARM-based chip and mobile-based chips to PCs. And, hey, you've written a lot about that from Computex over the past couple of years.
And I've reviewed a few of them.
Yeah. The dream is that you'll have ultra-light Windows PCs that'll last all day. They'll have mobile connectivity and everything. And we just have not seen that happen. I feel like the one thing that's missing from this MacBook Air is like, hey, give us some mobile connectivity. Yeah. Like, give us... Now that you have less hardware actually inside the machine, because everything is inside the M1 system on a chip, so the RAM, the actual CPU, a lot of the graphics, like all the graphics hardware, there is room to do more and add more components. I feel like Apple maybe sitting on the full redesign of the MacBook Air, because this is just the same case we've already seen, just the same keyboard. But the screen bezels are still a little too thick compared to Windows laptops. Like, certain things look a little dated. But the screen also looks great, so it's like I can't complain too much. And the other thing I'll mention here, the M1 chip, because it's ARM-based, it is essentially the same chip that is in iPhones and iPads. So you can run iOS apps on this Mac, and that is kind of interesting too. I mainly used it for some benchmarks, just to get like a sense of numbers. You could run some iPhone apps basically side-by-side with your desktop.
Nice.
But developers can also... basically keep their apps out of this whole ecosystem. So Google and Facebook have immediately been like, no, you cannot run our apps on macOS. No, thank you. So you can't have Instagram open alongside your email, basically, or at least not in a separate window. So that's kind of a shame. And I feel like that really hurts the usability of having these apps there. But it's still kind of cool. I think there's some iPad apps that would fit right alongside a desktop because they're built for bigger screens. And, you know, maybe developers will start taking advantage of this, too.
I will say, again, having not spent any time with a unit, just judging on pictures, there's one small complaint that I have, too, which is, like previous MacBook Airs and smaller MacBooks, this thing has two USB-C ports on one side. Yeah. And that's slightly annoying to me because, I mean, I've used a Galaxy Book Flex 13 for a while now. And the best thing about it is that it's got, I mean, first of all, it's got three USB-C ports. But the best thing is more that it has ports on both sides, because I'm reviewing another laptop now where the power charging side is the wrong side for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, oh, now to like rearrange my whole setup.
It's a stupid, simple thing, right? Like, I think the last time I saw that was the HP Spectre X360 that I reviewed like last year, and that only had things on the right side.
Right.
That is a pain. Apple's done this for a while with the Air, but yeah.
If you use a dongle, if you use a USB-C thing, which you have to because, like, it's just two ports, you might end up covering one of them if your dongle isn't built the right way. Like, if it's a little too wide, it's going to cover the port. So What?
You need a extension cord for your dongle. You need to like bring your dongles out a little. It's all a mess. And I do think having only two ports on a machine that's this, typically you'd be like, oh, you have an Air. You can only do so much with it. You know, don't stress it too much. It's not super powerful. This machine, just with the M1 chip, can play some games. Like I was playing Apple Arcade games like The Pathless. I even ran Fortnite in 1440 by 900. Mm. So not like super high resolution, but it ran it at 60 FPS. It crashed pretty quickly because Epic stopped updating Fortnite. But you can imagine a game like that running on hardware like this with no dedicated GPU. It's just the graphics that are there on the M1 SoC. That is still pretty powerful. The graphics-wise, in our benchmarks, it just blew away Intel's Iris Plus graphics. Their integrated graphics from last year that Intel was really hyping up. I have not seen it compared directly to Intel's Xe graphics. So that's like the new thing from Tiger Lake chips. But basically, Apple has accomplished something pretty great here, both in terms of performance and so many other things. I would like more than two ports, because if you're charging the computer, that's one taken up right away. And then that leaves you with just one more. So, you know, that's where the MacBook Pro 13-inch may be more usable, but then you still have only USB-C ports, but you get four of them, right? So that's something.
I prefer that. Speaking of the MacBook Pro, so the MacBook Air you reviewed with the M1 is the one with the cores in the GPU, right?
No. So there are, just to be aware as you review or as you're trying to buy this, the $999 MacBook Air has 7 GPU cores. The 1249 model has 8. Mm. I don't think there's going to be a huge difference in performance there. You know, it's just a single core. But if you actually want to use this thing for more like maybe heavy duty work, although at that point you're probably going to be a pro anyway, the 1249 model may make more sense. You can also spend an extra $200 to add 16 gigabytes of RAM to either of these machines. So I think that's a good upgrade, especially if you want to keep something for 4 years or so. So that's the main difference there. I reviewed the 1249 model.
Okay, so my question to you is, over and over on this show, we've recommended people stay away from first-gen products. Sure. What do you think this time around? Is it safe for people to go out and buy these things?
I would say, and this is a thing I was really also recommending before we fully saw these products. Mm-hmm. This doesn't really feel like a first-gen product because Apple has spent the past 10 years, you know, and more than 10 years, building its own chips for all of its mobile devices, for the iPhone, for the iPad. And we've seen every year that those things get faster and faster and faster. I think there was, it was a chart from, I think, a Nantech that was charting like the specific GPU benchmark over the past few years. And Apple is just like going up and up and up every year, like in a straight line. Whereas AMD and Intel, you're seeing some slight curves in how fast their chips are getting, but there's like a certain slowdown. But this year is sort of like an intersection point where Apple basically was forced to move over to their own hardware because their chips are getting more powerful than the stuff they've been getting from Intel. So if Apple had stuck with Intel, they would be limiting themselves and their own hardware. And it doesn't make sense, right? Because they're already building or they're already designing these chips for mobile. So it doesn't feel like a first-gen product. It feels like Apple has actually had years to hone this design. And I figure they've also spent a lot of time seeing how ARM chips would work in macOS and designing it. I feel like whereas Microsoft just like sent out the Surface Pro X and we've seen some computers just rush out to be like, hey, Windows on ARM can exist, except we haven't tested it. There's no app compatibility. Like it doesn't run very well, but it's here. I think I almost feel like Apple had spent at least a couple of years really honing in like how it's working on macOS because it doesn't feel first gen. So I think you're safe to buy this. This isn't something like the very first iPad or the very first Apple Watch where they're just kind of experimenting with this hardware and it's probably going to be abandoned in a couple of years. This feels solid and it feels workable for us and for mainstream consumers too. Yeah.
I think we had some like normal person questions from Ben, didn't we?
Yes. Here are my normal person questions just from like a consumer who could use, you know, a little bit of background information. I do eventually want to talk about benchmarks because I think benchmarks are really important. That's a little bit past the normal person questions, but here are my normal person questions.
Yes.
Does this MacBook Air have a headphone jack? Does the M1 line currently have a headphone jack?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's not anything to do with the M1. This Air has a headphone jack. Honestly, I was surprised. It was actually Windows PCs are the first I'm seeing that don't have the headphone jack. So I'm looking at you, Asus ZenBook Flip S that I reviewed a couple weeks ago. literally no reason for them not to have a headphone jack on that. But
so yeah, I know that you're saying that this is the exact same body design, but it seems like a little iterative update like this might be a good excuse for them to be like, oops, no headphone jack. But then again, they do have to retool the body for those sorts of things then.
They do. So yeah, any change takes time and energy, honestly. I could see them, if they removed the headphone jack but added two more USB-C ports on the other side and you had a dongle for headphones, like, okay, maybe that's more workable.
That was my next question. Usually Apple blames the lack of ports on the fact that they need to pack in more hardware. I think this is something that kind of came over from their mobile stuff, especially like why they abandoned the headphone jack. Because it's like, oh, well, you can't get a bigger battery. Yep, you can't get like all of this tech that we're packing into this body.
And that is much more limited space than a notebook. But yeah, that was their main argument for taking headphone jacks away from iPhones.
So the system on a chip dynamic should leave some more room for ports, right? Like, what could their next excuse be then?
I mean, I feel like, yeah, it's just having time to redesign the case and everything, because from what we've seen, I haven't torn this thing open, but logically the system on a chip just seems more compact. It is bringing together more of the hardware, so the actual motherboard, the actual PCB shouldn't be as big as before, so that should give them more room for things like more ports and other things. I do feel like they wanted to get this out quickly. That's the main thing. Like, hey, we just plop this chip in here. We have all these cases. We know how to build this. We're not messing with anything here. Let's just get it out to consumers. Because what's more important than the case redesign is making sure the chip works, it's not crashing, and the software is good. And I think the overall user experience is good. You know, a case redesign would just be like the icing on top.
Then that gets to the question of why not put a bigger battery in also? Like, they could really call out the entire industry by saying, like, oh, we've got a 35-hour machine here.
I don't think
they've gotten that much room out of the chip redesign.
That would be like double the battery size, and I don't know about that. Yeah.
That would be a lot of space. But to the point about ports too, it's like when we're talking about case redesign, we mean like these cases, like literal new holes need to be cut in the cases.
Yeah, new holes. They need to be manufactured in new ways. Like, that's a lot of testing
right.
that goes into
and
that.
And the components need to be arranged closer to the edge. Or if you're putting them like maybe in the middle where there's more space freed up, then like wiring the connections have to be made too. So there's more than just like, oh, we got more space, like squeeze some ports in there. It's a little
bit more complicated than that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a whole electrical engineering problem and design problem and everything. To what you were saying, Ben, I think they're already making everybody look bad battery-wise, because my experience using this thing is that the battery would basically barely go down, whereas on my MacBook Pro right now that I'm using for work, so it's like a 2017 era with, I think, an 8th-gen Intel chip, using that thing for maybe 3 hours will kill the battery. Like,
I know
MacBook
that.
Air,
I know that.
Or the MacBook Pro, at least the last couple Intel chips, Intel systems just have not been good with battery. And we've seen PC laptops go to beyond 12 hours with battery life, right, Sherlyn?
Yeah, so I was going to say, I think that the comparison you were making has partly to do with deterioration over time, just in general.
Yeah. It shipped like that, Sherlyn.
It shipped with just three. Oh, 2017. Okay, I remember that being an issue way back when. Okay, anyway, but recent PCs on our benchmarks have lasted, beyond 12 hours, some 14 hours too. Snapdragon PCs are supposed to last 20 to 22 hours of video rundown. But real world use, they're coming closer actually to more like 10 hours sometimes, depending on how you use. I want to stress that the Snapdragon PCs that I've tested are all like, they have LTE connectivity built in. So that hits your battery runtime a little bit more than the existing model of the M1 MacBook Air. So that's some context around it. But I will say we are moving towards like longer battery life in general. Apple does seem to be giving everyone sort of a run for their money. Like, PC people, I think PC makers are nervous. They're like, what are we going to do?
Most definitely. I'm sure, like, I'm looking at Intel, I'm looking at AMD, and, you know, they've all just made recent announcements. But I'm sure Intel in particular is just like, man, this is a punch to the gut. Because Apple just comes out with a chip that is significantly faster than anything Intel has really been working on. Intel is still within the M1 chip. Like, these the ports are Thunderbolt 4 ports, so Intel isn't fully out of the Mac ecosystem, but it is kind of embarrassing. Like, Apple just showed everybody up. And I'm not a fanboy here. I review Windows PCs most of the time. I love the XPS 13. I scored the XPS 13 the same as the MacBook Air M1 because I think that is the sort of also ideal polished Windows PC experience because it has practically no screen bezels and it's super fast and everything. I'm just really impressed with what Apple has done here. And I'm looking forward to seeing what people say like once they actually get to use this for themselves.
Speaking of Intel and AMD, show us them benchmarks. I, a normal man, will just smile and nod like I know what's going on.
I mean, okay, let's go look. If you go look at my review for the MacBook Air M1, the only like cross-platform benchmark I could really find was Geekbench 5. So even in that, right, the MacBook Air scored 1,619 points in single core, which is faster than the Dell XPS 20, Dell XPS 17, which is running a beefier H series Intel chip. It's faster than the Zephyrus G14, which is running the like highest end Ryzen 9 AMD CPU. Those things scored at around.
Faster than. Sorry, I just tested something that's a 10th gen Core i7, and it's single core is 911.
So basically, the fastest Intel and AMD mobile chips can get you around 1,200 points. The MacBook Air M1 with no fan, let me stress this, no fan, is able to get 1,600 points. And same with like when you get to multi-core performance. So that's like, you know, multi-threaded apps, things like video rendering and beefier things. That's also significantly, it scored 6,200 points just about on the MacBook Air M1.
That's a lot
because
crap,
it is the XPS 13, the Intel 10th gen XPS 13 that I reviewed earlier this year. That one scored 4,600 points. So in this respect, you know, the XPS 17, the Zephyrus G14 in multi-core, these are much more powerful chips. So these scored around 7,700 points. And that is the sort of difference, right? That's why you buy a beefier system. But the fact that an Air with no fan can get 6,200 is wild.
A word on benchmarks, right? I think that people sometimes question if benchmarks A can be gamed or B, how useful are they for real world observation? And I think that the point of having benchmarks is for comparison against other systems. So we're putting these machines all through the same sets of tests and the results are kind of how to compare because otherwise based on real world
this looks fast.
I'm just gonna be like, this thing took 3 seconds. Yeah, this thing took 3 seconds to render my Photoshop edit, whereas that thing took 2.5
and
seconds.
You don't know.
Like it's hard to tell. So people might be skeptical about benchmarks, and I myself am sometimes. But as a point of comparison, I do think that they're pretty useful.
Listen, I'm sure a lot of the online commentariat wants the unbiased, you know, reporting. Like literally benchmarks are that is the most unbiased things can get. It is just numbers seen by performing the same test, you know, and I'm just writing down the numbers. So there you go.
As someone who's been covering mobile phones for a long time and remembering when companies used to game the benchmarks, this is why I'm a little bit like nervous about relying too heavily on benchmarks, right? Because sometimes they tweak their system to detect like, oh, you're running Geek.
That was definitely, that was a thing, but that was also a thing by like second, third tier, you know, companies who are like,
right.
Please notice like us. Like, please.
OnePlus
it was
like
not
that.
A great thing. It was not something you expect an Apple to do or like a major company. But hey, anyway, those are the benchmarks. I think the system's really good. I'm looking forward to like getting this back in my hands and doing some further testing. I really want to bench the MacBook Pro M1 and the Mac Mini. We haven't even really reviewed a Mac Mini ever, I think. But I really want to see what it works like, you know, with this new hardware. So those are my thoughts on the MacBook Air M1. If you have any questions, if you want to chat about this, email us at podcast@engadget.com. We definitely want to report on this thing further. So I've just seen my review so far, and that was like with a week with this machine. But I'm sure we'll learn more as we test it further. Now on to a quick update of our never-ending election from 2020. Things are looking pretty good in Georgia. Our recount came in, and it very much leans to Biden, so that is very nice. But there is some news, and of course, like things, there are always signs of things just going badly. Earlier this week, Donald Trump fired the U.S. cybersecurity director, Christopher Krebs. And this is a guy who basically has had a target on his back over the last couple of weeks because his work at the cybersecurity department, I guess, like he runs cybersecurity for the country and was working on election security. And for the longest time, they ran basically a portion of their site, which was just dismissing conspiracies and like debunking rumors. And for the past couple of weeks, all they've been doing is debunking Donald Trump. So when the president would be like, oh man, this election is rigged, there's a ton of illegal votes, the USCIS would basically be like, no, this is the most secure election we've ever had, and there is no evidence of anything bad. So, yeah.
The USCIS?
Yeah, it's a thing. Okay. I believe that's the acronym. But he was basically saying the emperor has no clothes for the past week, couple weeks. So he was fired in a tweet. He, I think, was fully expecting it. I think he told papers that he was expecting to be fired soon. So, hey, if we, when we look back at the history of this election and kind of the influence of technology and misinformation and everything, this guy will be remembered as somebody who actually tried to fight against misinformation. So shout out to this guy. Shout out to Christopher Krebs. One thing I also want to bring up was, if you were on Twitter, I believe it was Monday night, for a single hour, one county in Michigan was basically trying to avoid certifying the election for Joe Biden, which I thought that was just a really strange thing, because it was in Wayne County, which is covers very heavily Democratic cities like Detroit, I believe. And it was two members of that county's board that was just really trying to not recognize the results of the election. And eventually they reversed their decisions and, they were shouted down by other members of the board. But it was a wild hour on Twitter where it looked like these people just don't want to actually count the results of the election. So that felt weird. It also showed, to me, it proved like the drama of Twitter, right? Like, so much can happen within an hour, this big controversy, and then a couple minutes later, oh no, everything has been reversed. But it's still a thing that happened, you know? I don't want us to forget the history just because it happened so quickly. And I think the last story I saw about this too is that they're even trying to rescind their approval of it now. It's a whole thing. But hey, Twitter is a really interesting thing to watch as all this news is coming down fast. Because if you're just looking at the news headlines, you're only getting part of the story, right? It is just kind of wild how much info you can get at once. That's also the danger of Twitter. But Sherlyn, tell me more about the danger of Twitter and too much Twitter.
Yeah. So I know, speaking of Twitter and things maybe not lasting forever on Twitter, not, you know, just happening for an hour, this week Twitter rolled out Fleets, the Instagram Stories competitor on its website. So if you use Twitter at all, you'll have seen a new row of icons at the top of your page. Basically, if you've never used Instagram Stories or Snapchat, which it's OG, which is where Instagram stole this from, these are, you know, little videos or things that take up the whole of your phone screen, and people can post text, images, videos, and they live only for 24 hours before going away. So this is, first of all, what Twitter? Why? I want an edit button. But okay, thank you.
We've talked about this
in previous episodes, whether or not, we can talk about the edit button later, but it was my joke that I can't get an edit button, but I can get stories. People have been going wild on Twitter, clearly, because not only is it, you know, something that's new for people to try out on Twitter, you can reach different mm-hmm. audience on Twitter as opposed to on Instagram Stories, but it's also kind of, and these reports have been coming out, it's ripe for harassment sure. and for flouting some of Twitter's guidelines and policies. So because these are like 24 hours only, and they're in stories, so they're basically in videos, Twitter's system might right. not be looking at them as closely as they're looking at you.
I don't think anybody was asking for this. That's my main takeaway. It's like, we don't need more Twitter that is unfiltered and unchecked, right?
I will say, I suspect that Twitter's whole thing for implementing this was they saw the success of Instagram Stories. Because my friends and I have been talking about this forever now, but like, no one posts to their grid anymore. Everyone's just posting stories. And people look at them all the time. People are posting them all the time. If you're a company like Twitter and you're looking at bumping your daily active user numbers, this might be,
funny, right? Because so like Twitter, like, and hey, everybody forgets about Snapchat too. It's like Instagram Stories was so successful, but it was really Facebook just stealing everything.
They stole it from Snapchat.
You know, that's the thing.
And then someone, one of the people I follow was like, oh, I've posted more Fleets than I have Facebook Stories. Mm-hmm. And true, because Facebook Stories is a garbage hole.
And it's also separate from Instagram Stories. And it's so
separate from
dumb.
Instagram Stories. Although don't say that, because now Facebook will force them to merge. Please do not put your dumb Instagram Facebook Stories on my Instagram. But anyway, so someone's already, like, you know, said that they've used Fleets more. Again, I think that for me, the way I think about it is, like, it's a very different audience that I'm reaching on Twitter. Yes, some of my Twitter followers also follow me on Instagram, but I feel like for me, Instagram is more a close-knit thing. More of my friends from home and friends here have Instagram than Twitter. And so, like, I'm torn. I'm personally not going to use Fleets all that much. I just do it for the being in the zeitgeist and having fun.
Yeah.
But the whole potential for harassment is also an issue, because when people reply to your tweets, those are public. When people reply to your stories or your Fleets, those are private. And people, I think, feel more emboldened to say whatever the hell they want in a private reply. Even though you can, still snap, screenshot them and share them if you want to shame this person, but it does open up this, like, other channel for people to get in touch with you. And who knows whether that's going to be a good or bad thing. I think that might not be great. So Twitter clearly has a lot to think about, and it did say that it is looking at how
it's more like, I don't know why, especially after everything Twitter, like all the criticism Twitter has faced over the last few years, why you would release a new vector for basically abuse, because it's a new vector for engagement, and engagement on the internet equals eventual abuse, without thinking about how you would protect people. Because I think this is, it doesn't matter. They care more about getting those engagement numbers up rather than making sure their users are safe. And this is the consistent problem we've had with social media over the last few years too. So I'll say this, to me, it just feels redundant, because isn't the whole point of Twitter is to just get your bullshit out there? Yeah. Sometimes, like, I actually miss the point where we were just, like, tweeting about dumb things and not just the fate of democracy.
Anything,
so I do kind of like to throw out those tweets some nights of just, like, a dumb thing, and then people would start engaging with it. And, hey, that's fun. But I literally don't...
That's what I do exclusively.
Just dumb tweets at night. I've seen your feed. But, yeah, I have no reason to produce a tweet that will disappear in 24 hours. Maybe they're chasing some of the users. I've seen some, like, high-profile users who would just, like, do a couple tweets, let them sit for a while, and delete the tweets. I think, like, Jabuki, the comedian, is, like, a good example of that, where he would sometimes tweet, like, a really extreme joke at times just to see, like, what it is and kill it before he gets, like, censored by Twitter. So I don't know. Maybe they're looking at that engagement strategy and trying to figure out how to do it. I am looking forward to never fleeting, always tweeting. Yeah.
One of my favorite tweets about, you know, Fleets since it rolled out was by Ashley Mayer. She goes, Twitter's product roadmap, Fleets, : stories but on Twitter, Beats, Spotify but on Twitter, Meets, Tinder but on Twitter. And finally, I don't know if we can say this on a podcast, but TEETS,
So scandalous.
OnlyFans but on Twitter. Look, I don't know. We can and can't say. But I thought that was hilarious. And yeah, who knows what else Twitter might be cooking in its little Twitter kitchen back there.
Okay, Sherlyn, that all sounds terrifying. Tell me something that doesn't sound as dumb as Twitter Fleets, such as Amazon getting into pharmacies? What?
I don't know if it doesn't sound as dumb.
I'm being sarcastic. Yeah.
I know. Long-time listeners know that telehealth is a recent pet topic of mine. And ever since I've been covering, you know, digital pharmacies and digital, like, medical health services, I've had this suspicion that Amazon was working on this in the background. Just because you kind of know they're getting into it. This is, like, 3 years ago when I first interviewed the founder of Roe, which is the online... I don't even know how to describe them. I don't think pharmacy is the right word. But anyway, and I have been asking them, like, Amazon's just going to do this and put you out of business, maybe. There is a difference, though, between what Amazon is doing and the competitors or the existing startups in the space are doing. But let's explain this a little bit. So Amazon announced this week the service called Pharmacy. It's not like Amazon's not been delivering medicine to your door before. Now it's just got a more unified storefront to do it. It's really working with insurance providers directly, and it's trying to help you. It can be the prescriber for some medications that you need. And it is specifically for a certain type of medication. So nothing that is classified FDA type 2, which mm-hmm. is a little more controlled. But the prescriptions that are, you know, that you can maybe ask Amazon Pharmacy for include things like birth control. I'm getting
Does it cover things like a lot of the startups we're seeing now, too? Because there are a bunch of medical startups, you know, things like Keeps and For Him, which offer like erectile dysfunction drugs and hair, like, you know, stuff for your hair to keep your hair from receding.
And that's the whole premise of those startups, too, because they operate in the same space of like lower danger drugs, right? Like not so controlled substances. And yes, that is the same space. But the criticism of Amazon Pharmacy so far from people in the industry and, like, for example, the founder of co-founder of Rose Z, who we've spoken to on the show before, says that it would have been great to see Amazon remove middlemen to drive even lower prices for patients rather than exacerbating some of the largest problems of the current system. But overall, they believe more competition is good for patients. Basically, it's not, to me, people are still going to have to rely on their insurance providers for some of these. If you have insurance, you know, you have a way in, you have another option. But the problem is right now, most people are already using some sort of pill delivery service. You've got Express Scripts. Yeah,
even CVS is doing it now. They've all adapted, which is great.
Right. So who's going to switch over to Amazon?
Yeah.
If your insurance, also your insurance provider is the one that determines who's your pharmacy. So you're just going to listen to them. And really, who you should be serving in this case are the people who don't have to be, you know, who aren't covered by insurance, who don't have to be like, oh, my insurance provider makes all the decisions, right? If you have the freedom of choice, that's where you might consider something like that. And Amazon's not doing a lot here to make it easier for those people, basically. It's fine if you have a Prime subscription and you're really into the Amazon ecosystem, but you know, other services, I know we bring up Roe a lot, but that's just one of the brands I'm most familiar with. They do kind of like the everything, right? From when you start to feel like you have symptoms, you go to the website, or when you have questions about what it is you want to take, like erectile dysfunction medicine, you go there, you fill out a questionnaire, you get to talk to a doctor, and you know, it's all like a more personal process. And Amazon Pharmacy, I mean, I haven't tried it yet, but it just seems a little bit more.
For sure. I mean, that's the whole Amazon thing. I do wonder if they're catering to people who are just lazy and don't want to go through, you know, a lot of the processes, because Roe and For Him, a lot of them involve like answering questions and going through like a bit of a medical thing.
As someone. As someone who's had really bad experiences before, like I've been in the ER, okay, from medication that I got through a website like that, and like I just was bleeding for months on end, nonstop. It was bad. Okay, so I would say I prefer the comfort and the security, the perceived security of talking to a medical professional.
I don't know if we can trust Amazon as a delivery for such essential things, just because they've done a bad job of even keeping their actual marketplace safe from counterfeiters and from all sorts of things too. Like, this is a company that I will always think of like, oh, they'll get into something because I can make a lot of money from it, rather than being like, oh, I can genuinely make this better for everybody and genuinely help. Like, Amazon doesn't really care about that. I'm interested to see where this goes, because we need more solutions for getting medication. The way things work in America just aren't great. But yeah, it sucks, because we're all still beholden basically to our insurance providers. I don't quite know what space Amazon's putting here. And I also like some of the companies like For Him and Keeps. Like, I like that they're around. It's easy to get access to certain things. Like, hey, I've occasionally will order things from For Him to keep my hair from falling out too much, you know, because if I stop that now, it's much easier than, you know, fixing it later. So I have liked that process. Yeah. And that's been pretty easy, and I've used them just fine. But I don't know if I trust Amazon to give me the right things, because I don't trust Amazon in general, right?
Bob Herman, one of the health reporters for Axios, I think put it really nicely. He said on Twitter, Amazon's new pharmacy seems more like rearranging deck chairs, plus also rebranding its PillPack acquisition from a while ago, than actual disruption. Amazon's not doing anything really new here. It's just entering a space that's burgeoning, and maybe looking at how I can profit. Also, I don't know how comfortable I am with Amazon knowing what pills I take and just reminding me the way it does. Like, hey, do you want to refill your dried mangoes and also your prescription? Like, no, leave me alone.
How many dry mangoes do you order from Amazon, Trillin?
Well,
I guess especially recently, it is a good way, but that is a common thing I pick up at like the health food store, but it is much harder to do that safely around. Yeah, they're very good.
I love dried
mangoes. Shout out to Dried Mangoes. Yeah. Where's the startup disrupting dried fruit delivery? Because I would love some of that. They're actually, it's Snackbox and some of those, right? That's probably what you go for.
I love those.
Let's move on to a listener email we received a couple of weeks ago. Apologies for the delay in addressing this. Mark Dell, who's in the chat right now. But hey, if anybody else wants to shoot us emails, podcast@gadget.com, we would love to take your questions. And it's a good way to just make us think about things in different ways. So Mark Dell is asking, he was thinking about getting a System 76 laptop to try something a little different than just having a Windows or a Mac. He knows he could just use Pop! OS, which is a Linux distro, on another device, but he's curious about the whole experience. Have we tried these devices? What do we think? So System 76 is a company that builds Linux-specific hardware, right? Without Windows or without anything on them. Sherlyn, have you heard of this company?
I have not used any of them. No.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't used them either, but I've heard things from people. I just can't quite see the point of them. I can understand like having, just buying a laptop that has, you know, a fully compatible Linux distro built in that is already, you know, addressed all the driver issues and everything, like it is just a pick up and go Linux machine. But at the same time, I do feel like the hardware looks fine. The internals are great, but I don't know if I can trust the case designs. I don't know if I can trust the reliability of this hardware, whereas you can buy something from, you know, any Windows PC maker. Hey, get the XPS 13 I love so much for pretty much the same price. Because the thing about Linux machines is that it used to be you were getting them significantly cheaper because you're not paying for a Windows license. But right now it doesn't really matter. Like, you could get the XPS 13, not spend much more than, you know, any of these System 76 systems, and have a lot better hardware to deal with, just because that screen is so beautiful. Like, Dell is just doing such great work. And I think you get better support too. I always am wary about the product support I get from smaller companies. But hey, if anybody else has tried System 76 and you want to chime in and tell us what your experience has been, definitely let us know. But yeah, I think those are my thoughts. Like, get an XPS 13. Get, like, there are so many good Windows laptop options. One thing I've seen people recommend is look for refurbished corporate laptops, especially like refurbished ThinkPads, which you can usually get for real cheap, for like under $500, and it may be a couple years old, but it's perfectly suited for Linux. That's an option too.
Okay, for Linux, sure. Yeah. I was gonna say that, like, I've heard of and have personally had issues with Lenovo devices in general, so I'm like,
Lenovo's build quality's not ThinkPad. Been great.
Those are not great. The refurbished ThinkPad's not gonna be that great, like, break in like 20 minutes. But yeah, I think that's a good call, is just like look for refurbished other brand devices and run your Pop! OS on there.
Let's move on to what we've been working on. I just want to shout out my reviews of the of AMD's Radeon RX 6800 and 6800 XT. These are AMD's first high-end GPUs in a very long time, and these are competing directly with the new stuff from NVIDIA. So specifically the RTX 3080 and 3070. Yeah. So it's pretty cool. I really like the 6800 XT. It is $650. In benchmarks, it performs better than the $699 RTX 3080. So like AMD is here to really compete. The 6800 is in a weirder spot because it's $579 and it's kind of competing with the RTX 3070. That card typically goes for around $499, like ideally should be $499. So it is faster than the 3070, but in some ways I think when I review that thing, I think the 3070 is a great deal in general because it gets you great gaming performance and great ray tracing. And ray tracing, both of these cards have hardware accelerated ray tracing. It's something we've been waiting to see for a while from AMD, and we know they could do it because both the PS5 and the Xbox Series S and X can handle that, you know? So AMD's hardware is powering those consoles. And the ray tracing on these cards, it's fine. but it's very slow. It's not like it's not anywhere near what NVIDIA is offering at this point. So you could really tell that NVIDIA has at least a year head start in terms of implementing and optimizing ray tracing. So I would not. You can't run some games with ray tracing on these cards, like Dirt 5, which also runs on the consoles just fine. But something like Control, which kills pretty much any system you put it on if you crank up ray tracing, I could not play Control on any system with these cards. Whereas with the RTX 3080, you could still crank up ray tracing and use a couple optimizations to make Control really playable and still get you 60 FPS. I really missed NVIDIA's DLSS technology with these cards, because that was a thing where they would render the game at a lower resolution, use AI optimizations to kind of upscale that lower resolution to get you something that looks similar to a true 4K image. But basically, it means there's less graphical overhead on the card and on your system, and the games still look good. AMD doesn't quite have something like that yet, but I hear they're working on a similar scaling feature. So anyway, these are interesting cards. I still think the 3070 is the best buy for most people right now. But if you want a high-end card, the 6800 XT is cool. If you have a Zen 3 CPU, I believe you'll get even a bit of a performance bump, because AMD has managed to make the memory interface pretty seamless between its hardware. But even if you have an Intel system, like, this will be a fast card. I just feel like the best deal is still the 3070, and the best overall performer, without going up to the crazy ass, you know, $1,500 3090, is the 699 3080. So that's kind of where everything stands. Competition is good, and hopefully, like, now, maybe now NVIDIA will also look at AMD as more of a serious threat in the high end space and not just the mid range space. So that's it. That's my GPU talk for the week. I also want to shout out quickly, I wrote up my experience using Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, Tales from the Galaxy's Edge, the new VR experience that's hitting Oculus Rift headsets today. That thing, it's super cool. I've talked about Vader Immortal before, and that was a great, like, linear story set within VR, you know, and in the Star Wars universe. This one's a little more open-ended. So you play as a droid repair technician who gets roped into this, like, you basically, was it the Guavian Death Squad? You encounter the Guavian Death Squad early on in the game, and you get stranded on Batuu, and then you could just hang out on Batuu. You can hang out in when the cantina's there. You could go out into the wilds and hunt and, you know, collect items and stuff. It is kind of an open world game, but there are also elements of quests. There's also, like, actual storytelling within it. There's a quest where if you collect a certain amount of ingredients for a drink, you can, the barkeep in the game will tell you a story about from the High Republic era about a young Padawan and Yoda. Ooh. From that time. So that's kind of cool that they can encapsulate different stories within the framework of this game. That specific experience is only 15 minutes long, but hopefully down the line, like, we'll see more stories and hopefully they'll be longer. But if you're just getting an Oculus Rift or Oculus Quest, actually, if you're just getting an Oculus Quest 1 or 2 now, play Vader Immortal first. I think it is a much better, like, mainline experience. But this is a cool thing to play around with. Like, let me tell you guys, I was watching the last episode of The Mandalorian and loving the season. Super good. We'll talk more about it later. But I immediately went from watching that show to jumping into this game in VR. And it just felt weird because I was like, oh, everything I was just watching on my TV, I'm just, like, jumping into it. And there's a weird sense of, like, cognitive dissonance in a way. Like, it just felt uncanny to see how fully realized the Star Wars world is within VR. But yeah, I thought this was really cool. If you have a Quest 2, definitely check it out. Trillin, what's up with you?
I have been working on some behind-the-scenes stuff, reviewing a laptop that hopefully you guys will see the review next week, and also doing some reporting for some year-end stories that I talked about last time as well. But this week, thanks a lot, Google, for the last-minute event on Wednesday, which was yesterday. You know, at 12:30 p.m. Eastern, Google launched, Google Pay had an event, basically introducing a redesign of its app and a new thing called Plex by Google. It has to be Plex by Google because Plex is otherwise very widely known as the media server app, but never mind. This is really, I think Plex sounds a lot like it might be an Apple Card competitor, but it really is actually just Google enabling some smaller banks and financial institutions to have a modern banking app. That's why you will not see names like, I think, Bank of America and Capital One on there, because those guys have really good mobile app experiences already.
Is this basically Google doing like Simple, like the online bank Simple, basically?
I'm actually not familiar with Simple, so I can't tell you what that is. But
they were like the only web-based bank for a very long time. So that was like the big thing with them. So it does feel familiar. Yeah,
a little bit. Mm-hmm. But so you can apply for an account, you know, via the Google Pay app. Yeah. And, right now it's not available yet. You'll have to join the wait list. But so currently there are 9 to 11 financial institutions that have, you know, confirmed that they're going to be working on Plex accounts. Mm-hmm. And one of them that announced yesterday as well is Citibank. And so it's the Citiplex account. There'll be no overdraft fees, no overdrafts, no minimum balance requirement, no monthly fees, that sort of thing. But you can apply online. And the whole spiel is that you have this great like app experience, really. You'll manage, like, you'll sign up and you won't get a card. You won't get a physical card, but you'll get a debit MasterCard. And then you'll also have, access to Pay, which, by the way, with the redesign is now like a mix of Venmo and Mint. You can do a lot of money transfers from there, which you could already do with Pay. But Google's redesigned the interface so that the homepage focuses on the people and businesses you interact with the most. So, like, for example, if I were to pay Davindra a monthly, like, coffee for podcast fee.
Yes, please do.
No, thank you. He would show up on my homepage as one of the heads of people that I, you know, interact with a lot on Google Pay. And then brands like, for example, Panera or, I guess, JCPenney or something like that. Are they still around? Anyway, would be also showing up on there if you make some sort of purchase at their store and want to pay via Pay. So, and then there's also the part of it that, again, is similar to what Apple was saying they wanted to do with Apple Card, is to help people understand their finances better. So the main differentiator here that Google has over competitors like, I don't know, Mint and other mobile banking apps too, is the search function. Because Google is so good at search, obviously. So what you can do with the Google Pay app, when you have all your, you know, bank accounts, your cards like linked to it, you can search for something like gym, or, you know, you remember you bought a smoothie at the gym, but you can't remember how much it cost. You can be like gym, and then it'll pull up all the transactions that are related to gyms based on like location, based on brand name, or based on product name, whatever. Or even it can scan receipts that you've taken a photo of from your Photos app or from Gmail. And that's, you know, of course you have to give it permission to access those accounts, but like then it will pull up those receipts and scan also for the information and show you the transaction you're thinking of. So that's one thing that really stands out about the new Google Pay app. But by and large, though, everything else seems like things that people have done before.
I don't know if I can trust any of this because of just general distrust of Google, especially them getting directly into finances and seeing your receipts. Like, okay.
I mean, they've already been able to do that. They're just making it, you know, within the finance app right now. Like, you think Google can see your receipts if you took a photo of it before? Of course,
that doesn't make it better, surely.
I know.
Like,
I'm not saying it's better. I'm just saying, like, you're.
Yeah. Now they're actually using the info.
Right. Yeah. It shouldn't be new fear. It's like existing fear that continues to exist.
It's existing fear, but also fear of Google, like, literally, they can tell all our transaction information, like, from our email and everything, too. But now they'll have even deeper details on that.
Yeah. So I was on a roundtable with the head of Google Pay, a few other folks. And one of the things they brought up when I asked about the privacy and security aspect is one thing is they won't share your transaction history to be used for targeted ads. Which is so important. I'm just like, okay, thanks for saying that. But it kind of makes me wonder what else is being, you know, tracked or searched. So I understand. I totally agree. There's a lot of, like, security concerns here. I personally want to try. I use Google Pay. So I'm going to, like, check it out and see if the redesign makes a difference. The problem is, I think Google will have a hard time convincing people to migrate from whatever service they're currently using to use Pay instead. So we'll see. We'll see. But that's part of what I was working on covering that event live was fun, I think. No, it was not.
It's cool to have like an actual event where you have to like, okay, hustle and write news.
There's a
certain energy with that. Yeah. So good job there, Shalyn.
Thank you.
I think it's going to be interesting to see, like, because we've seen the Apple Card. We've seen a bunch of stuff. I think it's just interesting to see how companies take advantage of this space.
Yeah.
Zelle is a thing, you know, a lot of banks are using to transfer money now because they want to have a way outside of PayPal and outside of Venmo. The space is going to get more interesting, but man, I can't trust anybody involved with it, but I guess that's just normal. Anyway,
well, okay, if you're listening, you know, if you're listening or watching and you're thinking of like the digital money transfer app you use, like Zelle, Venmo, Google Pay, whatever it is, send us like your thoughts. What are the wishlist features you want? Like for me, international money transfer that's easy and seamless. I don't care about paying a small fee each time. That's a big wishlist item for me. And yes, you can do PayPal, but it's still not very easy. So,
and it's also limited. PayPal and Venmo are like limited too. Yeah. So,
so send whatever it is that makes it easy to send my mom money. That's it. Anyway, send us your advice, your thoughts, and your wishlist items to podcast.
Sherlyn's mom, all your money. Yeah.
Yeah. podcast@engadget.com. Oh my gosh, I'm trying to get the email address out.
All right, let's move on to our picks. And just quickly, I want to talk about The Mandalorian Season 2, which I've already mentioned, but love this freaking show. It is a lot of fun. It is a great... The great thing about The Mandalorian is that it is a quiet Star Wars show. Like, it's a show that allows room for silence amid the like blaster shootouts and amid the like explosions and ship chases and everything. So it reminds me a lot of like the original trilogy and what a lot of people love about that. So I'm just really digging the season. It is leaning heavily on guest stars. I won't spoil too many of them here, but the first episode has Timothy Olyphant as a freaking, you know, space cowboy. And I am fully down with that. Like I think Olyphant should just be, make him a cowboy in every single genre moving forward, you know, so say we all. I'm really digging Mandalorian S2. So I'm glad it's still around. You can really see the money on the screen because it's sort of like you're watching a new Star Wars movie every year or every week. And that to me is pretty cool. It just feels like, man, I'm watching the future of entertainment here. We've talked a bit about this before where they're doing this unique production design where essentially there are giant LED panels on a set that they can project different sets and different worlds and environments on. So they can create a lot of shots that look as if they're on location on an alien planet and actually make it more realistic. So the lighting hits people, you know, in a realistic way compared to just having a green screen and having a digital background. So I'm just really digging it. It's a really fun show. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of the season. Sherlyn, what is your pick? I am waiting. I'm waiting for the surprise.
First, the thing you talked about with the giant LED screens reminded me of like Samsung's events where they'd have like huge the stage.
That's basically it.
Giant background. Right, exactly. Yep. So that sounds amazing. My recommendations this week, I'm deviating slightly from the horror picks. I want to, I've been actually keeping these recommendations in a, like on a list for a while now because I was like, okay, one day when I run out of ideas, I'll recommend these things. But I think it's time now to kind of bring them up. So I, throughout the doom scrolling election like days, I needed a break from all that stuff. So other than watching TV and whatever, I found it most enjoyable to decompress by actually surprisingly watching some like Instagram stories and TikToks and whatever.
Sure.
I am a young, okay?
Because like, you can also just like lay down in bed and like lay flat and watch.
No, but I want to be distracted because my brain's too like doom. so I want to start with the first one that really like brought a lot of like joy, I think, for me. I have three to recommend you guys. So the first one is Grandmama. I think y'all might have heard of this TikTok and Instagram account where it's basically this mom and her son Gray. He is adorable. He just turned 3, and you guys might know him from the video that went viral a while ago. He's the kid that always says thank you mama when she hands him a plate of food, and she posted a montage of like just a lot of these in a row where every time she hands him a plate of food he goes thank you mama, thank you mama, thank you mama, thank you, and he's like the thank you mama boy. Adorable. I mean, if you like cute baby content, there's a lot of it on Grandmama. I absolutely adore it. It's so cute. Okay, the second account that I started to watch around that time was Nicole Dubois, I think is how you pronounce her last name, or at Nikki Dubes. She's a comedian. And she has like different series of joke, like, I guess, skits, right? And one of them, which is my favorite, is the suburban mom character that she pulls out and plays. And it's just her going,
"You're finished in the bathroom? I guess I thought you still had business in there because you left the light on.
Mama needs her medicine." I'm kidding. Have a good one.
Hilarious. Like, I love a lot of the stuff that she does. And yeah, it was just, it's a really great break from what's on Twitter for me just to watch this. And finally, the third one is this account called Brunch Boys. Turns out Brunch Boys, this creator, is actually a regular listener of the Engadget podcast.
Cool.
Yeah, I was surprised.
So I will not make fun of the name Brunch Boys.
But well, yeah, I'm confused.
I get it. I also miss being a brunch boy. Brunch is one of the best things we had in the before times.
I know.
Like, as much as people would hate on it, yeah.
I'm confused because there's, I think, only one boy, but I don't know why it's Brunch Boys. But, I mean, maybe it's for all of you Brunch Boys. Anyway.
It's all for Brunch Boys, yeah.
Let's
shout out to Brunch, the lost art of brunch that we lost, because it was, I think, especially for overworked people like you and me, Sherlyn, who just like,
yes,
will go through the week without like eating proper things. It was always great to be able to just like go to a place, plop yourself down,
yeah,
and just telling a restaurant to please feed me,
yeah,
while I have an all you can drink mimosa,
God, yeah,
or Bloody Mary or something. Like, yeah,
I mean, for me, I always, I'm not a morning person, so anytime I wake up, it's time for brunch anyway,
right?
But
right.
Yeah.
It's a great meal for non-morning people because
exactly.
Brunch lasts until 3 p.m. Yeah.
Well, I'm sometimes not up yet by then. But anyway, point is, the Brunch Boys account, not only is it like amazing, so proceed with caution because it's going to make you hungry as hell. And I've like had to be like, I can't watch this any longer because this is making me very hungry.
Are you watching any other food shows, by the way? Like, just
not,
in general?
I mean, I used to watch Kitchen Nightmares and...
That's not...
I know. It's
like,
not
a
really
food show that will actually make you hungry.
I know.
Shout
I don't
out to
watch
everybody. Yeah, yeah.
Can't watch
Somebody
any of
Feed
those.
Phil. I just want to throw a shout out to Somebody Feed Phil, which remains one of the most delightful things on Netflix.
Okay.
But please continue, Sherlyn.
Yes, I'm going to finish my last thought about Brunch Boys' account, which is it. But the good thing about it is that, like, I already have... like seen from the account, like all these places I want to go to and it's okay to go places again. Like, I'm like, all right, I'm saving that there was like there was like a Mapo Tofu taco or something like that. Or like
that
a,
sounds
I don't
messy
know.
And way too spicy to be
I can't
taco.
Remember what exactly it was. Not a taco or something. But anyway, it was just like an interesting fusion of food. And I just like, oh, I'm going there next time. So just for the discovery by proxy, I think that's a fun account to follow. So, hey, with these three recommendations, I'm just like, I'm with the times. Hey. So I hope you guys enjoy relaxing to those. But definitely send me like any other suggestions. I'm here for all the cute baby and food content. And that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter and at the /filmcast/film.com. Check out our recent episodes. And hey, we started a Patreon, so that's a fun thing. We're producing more, and I'm really enjoying it.
If you have wholesome, fun, very not R-rated Instagram stories or reels or TikTok accounts I should follow, send them to me at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. I occasionally fleet. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, please. And subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
And just a quick thing. We're not going to have a normal episode next week because, hey, it's Thanksgiving. But I did record an interview with the director of Astro's Playroom, the awesome PS5 launch title. So keep an eye out for that. We had a really good conversation about Sony's new DualSense controller and kind of how they basically built the game around the design of that controller. So that'll be a fun combo. Check it out next week.